This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Thank you very much, Roger, and good morning to you and good morning, world. Thanks to our technology, we can talk to people all over the world here on WGN Radio Chicago. And Roger, listening to that forecast here in the desert in the Valley of the Sun, Scottsdale, Arizona, right next to Phoenix, wow. We could take a little of the moisture because it is extremely dry in Arizona, and the red flag warnings are up for fire prevention, because if you throw a lighted cigarette butt on the ground in the dry forage and growth that we have, you could start a fire very quickly. So we could use a little rain, but we're not getting that. It's not in the forecast out here. So anyway, we're with you here on this Saturday morning, as we do every week. Max Armstrong will be around a little bit later. Max and his guest, Ray Brownfield, will be talking about the value of farmland. Where is it today, and where does it seem to be going? Interesting discussion coming up. And this week, I had the opportunity to record an interview with Iowa farmer Bill Northey, but he's no longer an Iowa farmer. He is now the Undersecretary of Agriculture for Farm Production and Conservation. His confirmation to that post delayed nearly 9 months because Congress was playing politics, trying to trade that confirmation for some other legislation they wanted. And so he was finally confirmed about a month or so ago. So anyway, Bill Northey will be on the phone with us from Washington, D.C., and he's a longtime friend, and we look forward to sharing that visit with you. There's another industry of agriculture that is challenged today, and that is the farmer who produces hemp, because hemp is a basic crop. It's used for rope production in the United States, but one of the ingredients of hemp is marijuana. And as a result, this agricultural and naval product, rope, is being guided and is being treated as part of the marijuana situation, which makes it difficult for them to produce a product that we need. So they have formed a group called the Hemp Industry Association. It's the leading nonprofit trade association for 24 years, consisting of nearly 1,000 hemp businesses. And this week, they feel they got a break in Washington. They applauded the introduction by U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of the Hemp Farming Act of 2018. That happened on April 12th. The Hemp Farming Act of 2018, if passed, would remove industrial hemp from Schedule 1 of the Controlled Substances Act and federally legalize commercial cultivation of the crop, which it now does not have that legal option. And so the HIA is supporting the passage of the bill and is writing to Congress to pass the legislation during its session, thereby ending over 80 years of prohibition of the versatile hemp crop. And passage of this legislation would mean that American farmers may finally benefit commercially from the economic opportunity that hemp offers and supply the largest consumer market for hemp products in the world, that of the United States. So a victory for the Hemp Industry Association, a partial victory. They've got the legislation introduced. Now it's got to be passed before it'll be legal to commercially produce hemp, not for marijuana, but for rope and for other products. So we'll keep an eye on that. We've talked about it briefly over the years because it is a challenge for a crop that farmers were once able to produce and sell legally. Hopefully that will come back again. And the other note that we'll cover before we check in with Bill Northey, the February milk price. John Onken, who is the producer of the Agridairy Business Letter every month, sends us the latest numbers on that. And here's why dairy farmers are really challenged these days. The all-milk price for February in Wisconsin, $15.60 a hundredweight, down 70 cents from January's price, and that's according to the latest USDA price report. It is also $3.40 below a year ago. The U.S. all-milk price for February was $15.30 per hundredweight. That's 30 cents below the Wisconsin price, 80 cents below January, and $3.20 a hundredweight below February a year ago. And all of the 23 major milk-producing states had a lower price compared with January. So what about the five top dairy production state prices? California came in at $14.75 a hundredweight, Wisconsin at $15.60 a hundredweight, New York at $15.80, Idaho at $14.90, and Texas at $16.20. And then what about milk production in February? Well, nationally, it was up 1.8% from a year ago, with number one dairy state California gaining 3.5%. Wisconsin about even. New York down 2.3%. Idaho gained 4.8% in production. And Texas was up 5.5%. And Colorado showed the biggest gain with a 7.7% increase in milk production in the month of February. Some of the statistics on why dairy farmers are being challenged these days because of the price level. Well, we're going to talk about some of the challenges facing not only dairy farmers, but all farmers. And we're going to check in with the new Undersecretary of Agriculture, serving Undersecretary Sonny Perdue. We're going to check in with Bill Northey right after this when we come back here on the Saturday Morning Show. I'm delighted to have on the air with me this morning from his office in Washington, D.C., Iowa farmer Bill Northey, who is now the Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. That's been an interesting road, Bill, and you certainly were held hostage by Congress for a while. I can't imagine what that was like, waiting to find out what's going to happen to you.
Well, it was a little slow process. It took me a little while to get there. The whole process is deliberative anyway, because you need to go through several checks to be able to get there. But I had another 4-month slowdown is on hold. But I had a great job. I was Secretary of Ag in Iowa, a job that I loved doing. So right. It wasn't near as painful as it could have been for folks that don't have jobs and get stuck in those situations. So I had a great job, plenty to look forward to, a lot of planning to be able to be a part of. But I'm glad to finally be here.
Well, we're glad you're there, too. Now, farm production and conservation, I've not run into that title before. Is this part of the reorganization of USDA by Sonny Perdue?
It is, Orion. So in the last Farm Bill, Congress asked USDA to pull the foreign ag activities out separate from a combination of foreign ag service, farm service agency, that's the farm program activities, and risk management agency. Those three were together. And so the secretary pulled that foreign ag service out. That's my good friend Ted McKinney, who is undersecretary for trade and foreign ag and the foreign ag agency. And then in combination with that foreign, the farm service agency and risk management agency, the secretary moved NRCS as part of that and caused this kind of that customer-facing part, that farmer-facing part of USDA. So that created the new farm production and conservation mission area, the combination of those three agencies. Those agencies will still maintain their own individual identity, but will coordinate activities in the mission area together as we talk about those farm service agency offices and those NRCS offices out in the county. They often work together already, but now they'll work together in the same mission area.
So what are you looking forward to working on most, Bill? Because I know as an Iowa farmer, your interests are broad, but what are you looking forward to working on?
Well, there are lots of pieces. So certainly a farm bill is coming in front of Congress. We'll see what the timing is here as far as what Congress does, either the House or the Senate, on initiating the farm bill process. They've already been having hearings, and so look forward to continuing to support their efforts in looking at policy. But a big part of what our focus is also making sure that USDA works for the farmers in the countryside. So how can we be organized in a way that improves the flow of paperwork, of sign-up, of letting our agencies work more closely together? So that is both spending time here in Washington, understanding how those things come together, but getting out to the countryside and talking to folks. How does the farm loan process work? Can that be responded to quicker? Can we speed up that process? Can we make sure that folks walk into an office, they're even more ready to be able to sign up and do activities? Can we make sure that some of that activity can be done online as well? So before they come into the office or while they're on a planter going across a field, that they can go ahead and send in, start to certify their acres to Farm Service Agency for farm programs or to their crop insurance agent to make sure that they have the information as well.
You know, there are many things I like about Sonny Perdue as a Secretary of Agriculture, but something I like a great deal is his traveling. My golly, 35 states, and getting to hear from farmers and ranchers what they want. I did sit in on one of those listening sessions, and I've got to say he does a lot more listening than he does talking in those get-togethers with farmers and agribusiness people. And so I get the sense that maybe you'll be on the road or in the air quite a bit.
I think that I will. I don't know exactly how that timing's going to be because we've got lots of places to be, but that's certainly something I enjoyed a lot in Iowa. We had 99 counties in Iowa, and I traveled to every county every year. That's one of the things that, as you pointed out, also attracted me to the secretary, that he believes that you need to be able to get out to be able to hear from folks firsthand, and that's not just talk to them. That's to ask questions and hear from them. And I would guess that I'm going to be spending a significant amount of time traveling around to be able to understand what those issues are. And if I'm going to use my time wisely in Washington to make changes, I better know the kinds of things that folks want done by being out there and getting up close to their needs out in the countryside.
Are you getting any feeling at all if we're going to make the deadline on the farm bill this year? Because I don't think we have for the last two or three farm bills. But are we making progress?
You know, I think there's progress being made. We've got some folks that go up to the Hill and work with the committees as they're working on legislation. But we all read, and I'm not. I don't have any insight that's different than others out there. I do see where there where some folks had hoped that a bill would be out, maybe even in February, certainly in March. Now we're into April, and we don't have bills out yet. That when you start running the clock, it's a challenge to get done to get a farm bill done yet this calendar year, just because there's many different steps that it needs to go through and some issues that need to come about. So I think there's still definitely a chance that a farm bill can get done this year. There's still a desire by folks in Congress for that to happen. We're certainly very supportive of that process here at USDA and hopeful that that can happen. But we also have to think about the possible extension of a farm bill, what would be involved in that, be ready for that if that's what needs to happen at the end of the day.
Well, Bill, I really enjoy the opportunity to check in with you, and if you don't mind, I'll do it from time to time for our WGN radio audience, and I really appreciate your time this morning, and be well and be safe, my friend.
Well, I appreciate that, Orion. Always great to talk to you and your listeners. Certainly appreciate all the great work that you do. And if we can have many opportunities in the future to be able to talk, that would very much please me as well.
A visit with Undersecretary of Agriculture for Farm Production and Conservation in Washington, D.C., Bill Northey. We are about 1 minute away from the 5:30 news headlines here on WGN Radio Chicago. I think I shared this with you last week, and I don't know why this hit my funny bone the way it did, but I just love it. So if you weren't with me last week, this was one of those internet items that come across in volumes at times. But somebody sent me this on the internet: notice in a farmer's field. A sign that says the farmer allows walkers to cross the field for free, but the bull charges. I love that. I don't know why. I love it. The other thing I love, well, there are a lot of things I love, but the folks at Culver's have done so much to thank farmers for what they do to provide food that is served in the Culver restaurants. So mark down May 3rd on your calendar. Because on that day, every scoop will count at Culver's on Scoops of Thanks Day. On Thursday, May 3rd, guests can get a dollar single scoop of fresh frozen custard, and all of the proceeds will go to FFA and other local agricultural organizations that strengthen American agriculture and the industry's future leaders. I love that idea, and I hope you'll remember May 3rd. For a buck, you get a scoop of custard, but all of it goes to organizations that help education for agricultural people. And good morning again, and welcome back to part two of the Saturday Morning Show. Roger, listening to you talk about heavy winds, that's one thing that does happen in the desert. And when it does happen with no rain, we get dust storms. Well, this week, for the first time this season, we had some dust storms that were heavy enough to shut down traffic on interstates going through central Arizona. And the winds, yeah, they gusted 50 miles an hour or so. And a desert dust storm, no fun, but better than a tornado or a hurricane. So anyway, that's a little bit of what's going on in the desert. Oh, last night, Had dinner at my favorite Italian restaurant in the Phoenix area, introduced to me by Ron Santo, who, of course, lived in the Valley when he was a Cub player. And the name of the restaurant is Tutti Santi, and my wife, Gloria, and I were having dinner, and two lovely ladies came up to say, "We heard your voice, and you must be Orion Samuelson." And two ladies from Chicago who were vacationing in Arizona that happened to go to the same restaurant we did last night. So thank you to the ladies who came up to say hello. Right now, we say it's time for Samuelson Says, brought to you by Wink Products Company, makers of quality specialty cleaning products since 1947. I'm Orion Samuelson. This week, talking about my ongoing challenge on food labeling. The folks at Wink Products Company want to help make your life easier with a family of professional strength cleaning products that really work. Wink Rust Stain Remover is the number one liquid rust stain remover in the country. This professional strength formula dissolves the ugly rust stains on white sinks and toilet bowls, color-fast fabrics, and carpets. This little brown bottle has been around for 69 years, and it's still number one. To learn where to find quality Wink products, check us out at WHINK.com. I know that food labeling is vitally important to many people, but at the same time, I'm bothered by some of the food labeling that I'm seeing that I think appears on the label to help sell the product rather than honestly disclose any nutritional or non-nutritional values to the product. And I'm glad there is an organization called GMO Answers, and they work hard to do away with the myths and beliefs that are false concerning genetically modified organisms. And their most recent newsletter, they talked about vodka, and there's no GMO wheat on the market. But late last year, one vodka company started to heavily market their non-GMO vodka online and on social media. The only problem with this line of marketing, there is no GMO wheat. Non-GMO vodka is just one of the many products being put out by companies trying to hop on the non-GMO trade. And you know, it's been going on for a long time. I remember a decade or so ago when dairy farmers were adding bovine growth hormone to their dairy cows to increase production. And it wasn't long before we saw the non-BGH bovine growth hormone on milk carton labels. I took issue with the CEO of a dairy in Arizona that put that on the container and on the label, that there was no bovine growth hormone in their milk. I said, "How do you know? We don't have the technical equipment that can tell us the difference between natural and human-infused BGH." And of course, I have never milked a soybean plant, never milked an almond plant. And while I love you producers who produce the almonds and the soybeans, I don't think you can call it milk. I think that's false labeling, and it should be labeled a beverage. But food labeling will continue, and as a consumer, it's up to you to try to figure out what's right and what isn't. My thoughts on Samuelson Says. It's a quarter to six on the beginning of a not very pleasant weekend across the Midwest, and there's been a lot of that during the winter and spring season there, but we survived and we will survive. Well, it's time to check in with Max Armstrong and his guest. And Max, I understand you have a question.
What is land worth? We often ask that question. And visiting with us this weekend to talk about those prices, those markets, Ray Brownfield, Land Pro LLC is the firm in Oswego, Illinois. Also very involved for many years in the past in the leadership of the land appraisers, farmland managers, and rural appraisers. You guys still have that group, do you not?
We do. Yeah, we do. Very active.
Talk about, first of all, the farmland manager. He or she still is pretty doggone important in the whole scheme of agriculture, aren't they?
Well, we feel we are. We offer a service to people who are absentee landowners, investors, people who really, they love agriculture, they wouldn't be in it, but they don't have the time sometimes to be involved in every day-to-day business involving the leasing, the grain marketing, the conservation practices, all the technology today that's really developing at a rapid rate in agriculture, which is great. And so they retain professionals like ourselves to be of assistance to them, to help them really continue with their farming, the good farming practices, and of course to add to the income levels they hope and long-term valuation. That's really important to most people who own land today.
The farm manager is a partner with the farmer. But I think sometimes there's a perception that it's an adversarial relationship. Is it, Ray?
It really never. Well, we hope it's not. It's not intended to be that way. Most farmers that we work with, we see them as business partners. Where I say partners, I use that very carefully because certainly we don't represent that farmer. The owner-operator is who we work for. But we want a relationship to be really good with the farmers because we all think we all add something as a team to the ownership of that land. And that truly is what I found to be the most interesting part of my job after all these years is working with the farmers. I gain more from them than they do from me, I think, many times. The people are just really tremendous out there today and what they understand in technology and the genetics, all the things that they do. We bring, I think, an opportunity to them to add to the value of that farm sometimes in a way of adding tile. Lots of times owners don't understand the value of drainage and what that brings to mitigate the risk to that farm operator, but also adds value to the farm. And when it comes time to negotiate that rent, it's a little easier to talk to that farm operator and say, look, we're putting X amount of thousands of dollars into tile to help you mitigate your risk. Can you at least pay a little bit more for rent? And most people say, yeah, that makes sense to us. We're glad to work with you in that regard. So to me, it's really an important type of what I call business arrangement between all of us.
There is so much data being collected now on our farms. Is it generally being shared with that farmland manager? I mean, the producer has that data coming from the acreage that he or she has there, and it's a variety of data all through the growing season. Is that, in most instances, then openly shared with that manager who's representing the landowner?
It truly is in most cases. Yes, I've run into a few cases where there was a reluctance to provide that, and then we have to understand how we all represent the best interests, again, of that owner. That information is important to us. Even if it's a cash rental lease, you would say, well, why do you need that? Well, because we're tracking the involvement of that farm into what it can really do in production, and that's important to us. And in the event someday, if that farm should ever sell, that's extremely good information to any potential buyer who wants to track the yields as well, the soil test, what's been done on the farm, as well as the pH, the limestone. Those are things that are extremely important not only today but for the future. So those things that we do like to know. Now we're getting drone type videos ourselves. Actually, our company is getting a drone here soon, and we're going to be able to share that information with our owners and well as the operators if they don't have a drone. A lot of them have drones too, so it's getting to be really good information, I think, that's very helpful to all of us.
The owners, that's a rather a diverse bunch. Some of those are people who may have grown up on a farm and inherited it. They may have not been involved in agriculture in any way, but they recognize that it could be a valuable part of their diverse portfolio to spread the risk in that portfolio. And some are the big funds. Are they still active in buying farmland?
They're active to the viewpoint of being extremely particular about what they buy and what returns they can generate. Because keep in mind, that's not their money. It's money coming from various sources. It could be colleges. It could be pension funds. It could be unions, other things of which there's lots of billions of dollars to be invested out there daily into different kinds of assets, some of which is a small portion goes into farmland these days, which is, I think, a really good thing because it gives them a good diversity. But the fact is that they have to have a certain return, or they just can't do it. And I would tell you that it varies from region to region, but here in the Midwest, where we're located here currently, 2.8 to 3% is about as low as they'll possibly go, and they'd rather have higher, but it's hard to get anything better than that. So we do work with some funds out there today, and it's enjoyable to work with them because they work with the local farmers through our professional farm management, and they're willing to put money back in the land to make it better, which I think is extremely good.
I can't imagine too many of those fund managers, though, have the long-term perspective that is necessary with land. You have to be a little bit patient there, recognizing that over the long haul it will do well, but as is often the case, they are demanded that to return performance quarter to quarter.
Very, very true. Very accurate, Max. We do report them to the fund managers actually monthly and certainly quarterly on what's going on the farms. And they actually come out to visit them from time to time to make sure that we all understand what's doing the right thing for the fund, the people that brought the money to the table. So, yes, it's but we understand also it's at least a 10-year investment. It's a longer term. And at the end of 10 years, some of the farmland land may go back into the marketplace. Some may not, but they understand clearly it's a long-term investment. It has to be or they shouldn't be in the market.
5 years into a downturn of the farm economy, one could imagine that that might be forcing some farmers to not buy land, to back out of that market a little bit. After we saw those robust years around 2012-13, we saw the farmers still continuing to buy. Are they now, after all this time, Ray?
They still are. I think that statistically, 62% that we found here in the Midwest are in buying farmland. 60% of all buyers. That's a pretty big number. But I would tell you, it's not the frenzy it was back in 2013 when we had a drought and we had the real high prices where there was more expendable income to come into the marketplace. They, too, are being much more careful about what they buy. But they're still out there, and that makes sense because the farmers, the owner-operators, look at it as a long-term investment for them and their families and hopefully their grandchildren if they can do some really good estate planning. And I think that's a wonderful thing. That's where we like to see it with the farm families. And so we still see them there, particularly if it should go to auction. It's interesting if it's a 40 or an 80 or a smaller piece next to several farmers of whom hopefully they'll see each other in church and be happy. But on the other hand, they may be very competitive when it comes time to buy that land, and they're going to be there if it's good quality ground that makes sense to their addition to their currently asset balance.
You mentioned auction. We have heard of folks exiting this business, and some simply weren't able to manage their risk effectively in a very, very risky climate these days. How much of that is happening out there to put land in play?
We hear of it. It's not as great as some would think. I think, and they really probably most times it's very private. If a farm operator, owner-operator has become stretched and financially speaking, his creditor says, hey, look, we need some liquidity, we can't continue, then what he will probably, he or she, will go to people locally and say, you know, I've got this 40 and 80, I know you'd probably like to add it. They like a lease back if they can get it. Sometimes they can't. But generally, it's something, and I can understand it. It should be very private. People are not happy to have to do it to begin with. And so if they do, they hope they can go to somebody local or a local investor who may say, yeah, I know you well. I'll buy it. I'll lease it back to you. And that'll hopefully solve your issues out there. Very few that we know have gone to auction at this point. There could be that. I think if, you know, we don't know what will happen in 2018. We hope it's going to be a decent year. But I think their people are stretched. I think there's happened, and I think some of the fellows maybe paid a little more in their business model for cash rent than maybe they could. Mm-hmm. Maybe they bought more machinery than they should have. So we're going to see a little of that, and we just hope they come out okay.
I was with a young couple sometime in the past 45 to 60 days, and they were in a situation where a longtime farmer, veteran farmer, decided it was time to leave the business. He had no heirs, and he set them up. He came to them and said, I want you to have this farm. And you know, there were almost tears in their eyes as they were telling me about this. I almost cried listening to them. That's a rare thing, but there are many instances where farmers will target a younger producer. Am I not right about that, Ray?
You're absolutely correct. We see it from time to time, and it is a very emotional thing for me as well, Max, to see that. Because, you know, I'm a farm boy like you. That's where we're born and raised. That's where our hearts still are. And to see that opportunity happen, it's wonderful. Because it's hard for the young farmer family to get started today without that kind of help, without inheritance, without something to get them going. Because, one, it's highly competitive to get more land. It's really, any farms we have that come up for rent, we have a list of people. It's not a problem getting them rented. And the cost of machinery and just the cost of inputs are tremendous. So I hope that if that should be the case for people who have no other place to go, that they do look, because there's some really good young farmers. Yeah. I mean, today we're blessed to see some of them, and we're fortunate in our company to work with some that are, I think, outstanding young people, just outstanding.
I think this was the case where this elderly gentleman had watched these two grow up in church and watched them through school, and he knew what they were capable of, and knew their ethic of caring for the land, and that's exactly what he wanted to see.
And my thanks to Max and his guest, Ray Brownfield of LandPro LLC in Oswego, Illinois, for that discussion that's always at Coffee Shop Conversations in rural America. What is farmland really worth? What is the price of farmland? We'll be back with some final comments when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. Before I leave you this morning, a couple of big surprises to me in the commodity world this week. On Tuesday, Argentina, which is the world's largest exporter of soybean oil and soybean meal, booked its largest import purchase of U.S. soybeans in 20 years. They need those soybeans to fulfill contracts they've already made on the production they expected and didn't get. And then yesterday, Argentina, for the first time in 26 years, opened its market to importing U.S. pork. Another surprise. And so Argentina going the other way, but that's because of the drought that cut their crop to 37 million tons. Well, before I leave you, thanks to Ben Cortez for doing the engineering work in Chicago to make this all happen. Special thanks to you for joining us here on Saturday morning as we talk about America's most important and basic industry, agriculture.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.